everyone. Welcome back to the Earthon Survival Guide, the podcast for all disciplines, paths, players, and game masters with requesters Josh and Dan. That guy is Josh.
And that guy is Dan.
And on today's podcast, we will be discussing all things horrifical part, 19, 20, something like that. We have more horrors to discuss tonight. And in fact, we're going to talk about Nemesis and then Chanterelle's horror. So if you have any questions for us, please feel free to drop us a line at edsgpodcast@gmail.com. Tell us you like us, tell us you hate us. We don't really care. We're going to keep doing this anyway. So on to our first one. Thoughts on any of these two first off, Josh?
I was going to say, we're starting to get into the big guns. If anybody has been sort of following along.
Or trying to figure out the pattern.
that Dan put together for this. We have basically been slowly climbing up
horror ladder. Yeah.
The horror ladder based on the legend awards listed in the horror book. So as we have been going further and further along, these horrors are worth, according to the scores in the horror book, more and more legend points. And so they are getting progressively more and more
formidable.
Iconic and formidable. I mean, so even some of the lower ones are formidable in their own way, but we're really getting into some, like, tonight's are they're all wonderful. Like, again,
they're all fantastically evil.
Coming back to the theme that has been recurring as we have been discussing each of these horrors throughout the course of the series.
Oh, yeah.
Is how each of them is different, but still sort of recognizably a horror, and how they each have their own shtick or modus operandi or
aspect of evil
aspect to make them special and unique and interesting in a way that you don't really get in a lot of other games. Like, each of these are characters in a way that presents you with a personality and motives and tactics and plans that they can create that you don't necessarily get by reading an entry on, say, a type 5 demon in D&D, even though that is also a potentially formidable opponent.
Yes.
You end up needing to come up with your own character that is based on this sort of template. With this, you don't have a template that you then need to make a character out of. You are given characters, and there is no need for a template because each of them is special and different and unique and interesting in their own ways, in a way that a book written by and contributed to by a bunch of different authors shows you the diversity and creativity that was available to FASA back in their heyday of the 90s.
Oh, yeah. This is each essay is wonderfully crafted and in setting. And so it's not just a 30,000 foot view of stats and motive. It's always put forth from one character's perspective, sometimes the horror's perspective, which I find those absolutely fascinating and wonderfully done. And the name of this one is fantastic because Nemesis is classic Greek mythology naming convention. And so we've always used this. I mean, Star Trek Nemesis was movie 9. Nemesis and Nemesis, plural, have always been your polar opposite from the heroes. And so why would you not have a horror named Nemesis?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a slam dunk.
No, absolutely. And what is interesting here is that Nemesis as a horror doesn't generally have player characters or other name givers as those that it is a nemesis of.
Yeah.
It is a nemesis of other horrors. And the way that it operates and what it does is, again,
unique.
It's awesome. It is yet another different take, another different approach to this kind of situation. And we're going to get a similar one of the ones we're going to talk about in our next horrors episode. is going, we're going to step outside of the horrors book for a moment to talk about another significant named horror, but we'll get to that in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. So Nemesis is the master of metamorphosis and deception, which I find hilarious, as that's the opening sentence, because they always appear as a human, male or female. They apparently just don't like the other races. They don't like to imitate the other races or metamorphosize into the other races. They go with human, I think, to be as bland and generic as possible, because that's how I see humans in Earthdawn. But the interesting thing, again, about this horror is that when they metamorphose into a human to be deceitful, they are always beautiful and stunning and a cunning entity. And so they are absolutely putting on this disguise of the best version of a human that can possibly exist. So no matter what, you are naturally attracted to them. And so they've got your attention no matter what. The only way you can tell them they're human from another human, A, they're exceptionally beautiful for this horror. They have eyes that are the color of like blue lightning. And they can always usually explain that off as it's a birth defect or a magical spell or a lingering after effect of something. They'll make it fantastic and really sell it to their uniqueness. But they always dress in light clothes, never wear armor, and they love bright, flowing, like silk sashes and things like that. So they are fluid and flowing and beautiful and pretty and just attractive as all get out, because that's what Nemesis is going to do, is they're going to use their guise as a little tiny fish hook to just get you to pay attention to them, because that's all they really need.
Yeah. One of the interesting things with regards to Nemesis's appearance is that there is no record of what its natural form is.
Yeah.
The entry talks about a couple of adepts who have seen Nemesis close to death, and it just rapidly shifts between different guises that it has worn previously. There is at no point where it apparently takes on its natural form, which reminds me a little bit of the Deceiver.
Oh, yeah. Fair.
Where there is not any real indication of what it normally looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Its astral form is, again, still human looking, but there is a lot more obvious magical potency that is present there with dark lines and tendrils of energy that kind of emanate out from its astral form, extending out and getting lost into, like, fading into
the far reaches
of astral space.
Yeah.
With hundreds, if not thousands, of these tendrils coming off of its body, as the description says.
Yeah. And each one of those lines represents a connection to an adept.
If
that's true. Yes. But you have to think about that, the tens of thousands that would actually be, because, yeah, and those are just for, I'm a visual person, those lines in astral space are like pulsing black and purple.
Yes.
So I love the fact that the astral form is human and the physical form is always human. So does this mean that humanity is the ultimate evil? It's a philosophical question that does not need to be answered. It's rhetorical. So this is, Nemesis, by the way, is kind of a new horror. The word is that they arrived right at the end of the Scourge, because there's no record of them before the Scourge. So either they were better at this or they are new. And what Josh said is not exactly wrong. It bestows horror-slaying knowledge, horror-slaying weapons, and magical items as a lure. So this is the fish hook. So once it has your, it has your attention to look at it, then it will actually try and, you know, ask you what you're doing and sell you, upsell you, convince you that it has exactly what you need to take care of whatever horror you're talking about. And so it has the antidote for your problem, because it doesn't mind selling out its brethren. That's how evil this thing is. And it's like, yeah, I don't care about the competition. Go ahead. Go after, you know, Artificer, and go after Virgil. Go ahead. I have something that'll take care of it. Because in its history, right after the Scourge, Nemesis established itself as a slaver in league with Thera and other things because, again, it's just pure evil. It has built strongholds in Iopos, Jerris, the Liaj Jungle, the Twilight Peaks, the Servos Jungle, Europa, and in the Kakavik Mountains near Parlaenth. So that's seven strongholds. So yes. If you don't have enough to do with Nemesis, just pick one of Nemesis's strongholds and make an adventure out of that. That's a whole new care to delve into because it's different than a care setup. It's a stronghold setup. And so it'd be more like a fortress or, and there's even rumors that there were gladiatorial combats between slaves just for Nemesis's and other patrons' enjoyment, just because you could.
Yes. Sort of an unaware horror cult situation where, unlike in some of things like the Cult of the Great Hunter or some of the other organizations that worship horrors, Nemesis's strongholds and those who go and attend events there are going to be the rich and powerful feeding their dark desires and that kind of thing. I'm reminded, as mildly controversial as it might be, the Canto Bight, the casino sequence from The Last Jedi.
Right.
Where you've got all of the rich and powerful folks who, whether it's the Empire or the New Republic or whatever.
Yeah.
Whoever is sitting behind the desk doesn't make a difference. I've got lots of money and I'm going to indulge myself.
Yes.
I continue to have wealth and power regardless of who
is in charge.
Yeah, there was a similar kind of thing expressed in a recent episode of The Mandalorian, where we had a sequence that took place on Coruscant.
Hmm.
One of the characters like giving a presentation or like the Star Wars equivalent of like a TED talk.
Yeah.
And afterwards is like talking to people and it's like, oh yeah, it's like New Republic, Empire, who can tell the difference? This idea of the 1%, the strong, the wealthy, the powerful, those who are ultimately kind of insulated from real life in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And how Nemesis presents themselves as this cultured, attractive, sophisticated, suave, personable individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Reminding me a little bit of Ezerthgrath in a way.
Oh, yeah.
But without the monstrous appearance and without the bitter, toxic jealousy.
Yeah, the undercurrent.
Yeah. For Nemesis, it's not personal. For Ezerthgrath, it always is.
Yes.
Kind of the difference there. But yeah, Nemesis looks to corrupt and destroy adepts by giving them what they think they want or giving them what they think they need. And those gifts are poison pills and allow the horror to get its hooks into them, ultimately corrupting and destroying them and gaining a great deal of satisfaction.
Because Nemesis is not above, by the way, selling you and your party each a magical item that you desperately want, because the mechanics behind what it does is it boosts those magical items. And then you go face the horror and it has no problem letting that horror know that you're on the way, because it wins both ways. It got its tentacles into you, and then, by the way, it told the horror that you're coming, so it doesn't mind playing both sides.
Yeah, it's a situation where Nemesis really likes the idea of corrupting the heroes, and corrupting the heroes with the very tools that they are using to fight the darkness.
Totally.
That there's an irony to it that I think Nemesis really, really enjoys.
Oh, it's a delicious irony.
Yeah. And again, another patient horror that is willing to let adepts hang themselves, like giving them plenty of rope with which to lead to their own defeat. A very kind of Shakespearean tragedy kind of method, where in the desperation of trying to save people, they are condemning themselves.
Yeah.
Just a really interesting twist on the situation. In a sense, there has never, ever really been any kind of consideration of the horrors being collectively working together.
Mm-hmm.
They all kind of have the same goals, ultimately, in the sense yeah. of looking to corrupt, feast upon, and destroy name givers.
Yeah.
But there's no real sense of coordination between them, broadly speaking.
Yeah, they're all out for themselves.
Yeah, Nemesis is ultimately willing to sell out other horrors if it gets it more of what it wants.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the tasty, tasty feelings that you get when those that you have ostensibly been helping discover that they have sold themselves to the devil. There is a real classic deal with the devil kind of stories where the devil shows up and gives you what you ask for and you don't realize what it is that you have given away
yeah.
as a result. A lot of those stories, of course, often end up with clever people being able to weasel their way out of the contract. Devil and Daniel Webster, for example, being a classic story along those lines, but quite a number of other examples of that. That's the situation that you're looking at with Nemesis, a horror that is willing to give you what you need to get out of the frying pan, only for you to find out that you are delivering yourself into the fire.
Yeah. I was trying to, for the longest time, you said deal with the devil story, and I could not remember the name of the story I was trying to talk about. Faust.
Yes.
It's a very Faustian take on a horror. Yay, my brain kicked in eventually. So other things about Nemesis. Nemesis not only is a horror that doesn't mind being beautiful and cunning and drawing you into themselves personally, but Nemesis has pawns. It has created its own little horror spawn pawns that are also beautiful humans, but they're the ones that also do some horror, some selling of horror information. And once it's agreed upon that the player character will take on that information or take on that magic item or take on that weapon, that person is doomed, because that is when the horror marks you. And the human agents offer all the stuff up as well. So really, it can mark you through it, all, any of its agents. So that's how powerful Nemesis actually is. And after being marked, Nemesis plants a thought worm in you.
Yes, thought worm being a classic horror power that allows the horror to communicate across great distances and yeah. to potentially wreak havoc and cause problems on the person marked. There were a couple of interesting and unique powers that Nemesis has.
Yes.
First off is a power called Horror Lore, which mm-hmm. basically allows it to learn the weaknesses of other horrors to gain that knowledge that it can then sell to or provide to adepts that it is manipulating.
Yeah.
That horror lore is what allows it to enhance the abilities of weapons that it provides against mm-hmm. the target horror and things like that.
Yeah.
It is a mechanic that requires the horror to spend karma in order to learn those things and then spend karma to take advantage of those weaknesses that it learns in terms of a mechanical sense. It's also got the transport power. This is what allows it to rapidly get from location to location between its various strongholds.
Yeah.
It can move between them just by using this power.
And it usually takes like one round or two for it to get there. So it is lickety split across yes. the map of Barsave.
Absolutely.
And then it also has some spells, because what Nemesis does not like is a straight up fight. Lest you bruise its pretty face, by the way. That's just my own personal take on it. But it does not like a straight-up fight. So if you are going to fight its physical form, it will use every single spell it has just in an onslaught against you to kill you quickly so it can get away.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the Game Master's tactic is, by the way, just throw everything you have at it in a barrage of spells and retreat.
Circle 9 wizard spells are the equivalent of what it's got. It's got, looking at first edition stat block, 10 spell actions per round.
Yeah. No slouch.
Yeah, no slouch in that department with, you know, spell casting and effect steps in the mid-20s.
Oh, and let me add something on. Here's a thought. Up to ninth circle wizard spells. So all first, second, third, fourth. Yeah, all those.
Exactly. So. And then on top of that, of course, it also has damage shift, a wonderfully fun horror power.
Oh, yes.
It also has animate dead.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's in addition to its other abilities. In one sense, it is physically weak. Its physical defense in the first edition stat block is only 7.
Oh, that's easy to hit.
Yeah. I mean, it's got 20 points of armor, but with a physical defense of 7, you are likely to be getting those high results to be dealing extra damage or armor defeating hits, depending on which rules edition you're using.
Yes.
It also doesn't have much in the way of death or unconsciousness rating.
Yeah.
It's only got a death rating of 50. If you are able to get the jump on it.
Mm-hmm. And have a pretty decent, you know, spell repertoire of shielding.
Right. Yeah. Then there is a possibility that you could physically take it down, but it would require a successful ambush kind of situation.
Yeah.
And considering its very high mental stats, it is probably rather difficult to get the jump on it that way, particularly where it is cunning and patient and generally with its thoughtworm power will know where its marked victims are and if they are coming for it. Mm-hmm. Its ability to transport means that if you are taking it on in one of its strongholds,
yeah,
it is able to escape quite a significant distance.
Yes.
Relatively quickly. So fights against the horror, if you ever do actually get to that point, are apt to be very frustrating.
Yeah.
You might feel like you are doing something, but then it is able to turn the tables very quickly with its magical abilities and with the cult of sorts that it has built up around it.
Mm-hmm.
It is likely to have minions and cannon fodder, and with the animate dead power, cadaver men or potentially more powerful undead creations that we have talked about earlier in this series.
Totally.
Certainly not something you are likely to easily catch by surprise and eliminate. But the fact that there are adepts who have been there when it has been close to death means that it is
possible.
Possible. It is just very, very difficult.
I just had this idea for a big epic campaign where it would be like a legacy campaign where you would eventually have to coordinate 7 different groups to infiltrate all 7 of its different layers at the same time. And so that way, when it does bamf out of one into the next, that secondary group is ready to take on Nemesis at that point. And so eventually you leave no ground for it to go to. And you've coordinated these 7 different groups of characters to literally finally take out Nemesis completely. I don't know how to write that, but I think
that's one
awesome
possibility. The thought that just occurred to me is that perhaps what you would need to do is research and create or perform some kind of high circle ritual at a stronghold in order to sort of cleanse it or remove it from the network.
Yeah.
Remove it as a place that it can retreat to.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, as you are doing that and the amount of travel that you would need to do between them, it is likely to draw its attention and start turning all of its focus on stopping you.
Totally.
Yeah, Nemesis would be a very interesting companion to games that are dealing with slavery to a certain extent. If you've got, say, a Questor of Dis that is an enemy in the group of the group that is involved in slavery and whatnot. What's it called? The Iron Legacy, I think, is a secret society.
Yes.
Devoted to slavery. Because of the connections that Nemesis has with slavery, that is something that could be interesting there as a higher powered patron that might make the slavery group that you are going against a little bit more of a challenge, and that you maybe kind of learn that Nemesis, this horror, is the power behind the scenes, in a sense.
Yeah.
There is, of course, if you want to go with a really kind of dark game that is focused on the horrors, where that kind of betrayal and actual corruption threat to the player characters could be there, you know, with Nemesis being concealed, perhaps doing their usual, oh, I am just looking to try and help defeat these foul entities. Mwahahaha, now you are in my clutches. That is a situation where you want to, obviously, while not necessarily giving the game away in terms of the twist or the surprise, but you would want to make sure that that's something that your group is willing to deal with as a possibility in terms of story and how much of a direct threat to them it could be. There is also the potential problems that you could have if you don't want to directly involve the group or have your group be targeted or corrupted by Nemesis. Mm-hmm. Because it targets adept groups, because it targets adepts, you could run into plenty of allies or former acquaintances or whatever within the sort of broader adventuring community that might run afoul of Nemesis.
Yeah.
The Grim Legion, for example, would be an organization that would, to a certain extent, be kind of a interesting target for Nemesis to go after, with the Grim Legion's focus on defeating horrors. How far are they willing to go to do that?
Yeah.
If you want to go back to talking about it targeting player characters, maybe even it not making a secret of what it is and what kind of deal are you willing to make. If you have a sort of major campaign opponent that is a horror that the group is struggling with, hey, I can offer you that information to defeat this thing if you want. And so not making it like a surprise twist, oh, ho, ho, this wizard that you thought was helping you was a horror all along. But yeah, I can help you do this. Oh, yeah, I'm a horror. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's please. And maybe starting small and giving them a little bit of something as a gesture of good faith, and that it works and it does exactly what he said it did.
Mm-hmm.
What does that?
And now I got you.
Dark bargain, like going into it knowingly, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's always the fun of maybe attacking its network and the slavery operations and the strongholds and whatnot that it has, and, you know, trying to take down that support network that it has created around itself.
Yeah. So I think Nemesis is fun. As we've said before, we have some straightforward horrors and some devious conniving horrors, and Nemesis is a nice blending of the two.
Yeah, Nemesis has the deviousness and the patience and the charm and the personality that goes along with some of the more interesting horrors from a narrative standpoint, coupled with the similarities in some regards to like Ysirthgrath in terms of the personality and the charm.
Yeah.
We've got the network of individuals that you see with Bone Crown, the usurper, who builds that cult following, that network of worshipers around it. There's a little bit of that going on here. But then we've also got that deal with the devil Faustian bargain that is sort of the unique twist and what it can offer in terms of weapons to use against other horrors and what people might do.
Yeah.
Out of desperation.
Agreed. So pivoting now to Chantrell's horror.
This is an oldie.
Yeah, this one goes, I think this one goes back to like the very first source book.
Yep, Chantrell's horror shows up in the original first edition book. It is one of, I believe, three named horrors that is in the first edition book.
Yeah.
Verjigorm, Chantrell's horror, and I think Hate is the third one.
I think you're right.
Hate does not show up later on. Hate is only in first edition book, but I think Hate is a third that's in the player's guide or in the original first edition rule book.
Fair enough. So Chantrell's horror has never been observed in the physical world, only astrally. But if you do visit it, if you do happen upon it in the astral plane, it is a bloody, demonic humanoid suspended in a metal frame, and the edges of the frame have hundreds of small, whirring little saw blades made of all kinds of metal, including orichalcum. And Chantrell's horror is, again, unique in its modus operandi. It prefers to attack anybody's horror marks those horror-marked people. It chooses to attack their family, their friends, and their loved ones. It's got a very unique power to do so. We'll get to that in a minute or so. But Chanterelle's horror, it's named after Chanterelle because Chanterelle is a troubadour famously attached or cursed to it. And so it's just, that's where it got its name from, because really there is no actual name that's ever been discovered about this horror. So any spell, any ritual you're ever going to do that involves the name for this horror isn't going to work because it doesn't have a name.
Yeah.
Where to start?
Yeah, where to start? This is another one where the story is a lot more interesting, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
This is a horror that it feels like is there for mood and an example of some of the more devious and nefarious and sinister and evil that horrors can perpetrate.
Yeah.
Again, we're getting into these super iconic, more powerful entities. Mm. And this feels one that would be right at home in a Clive Barker story.
I was thinking the same thing, like Hellraiser.
Yeah. From a physical description standpoint, there is something very Cenobite about it. Yep. Very Books of Blood.
Mm-hmm.
This does feel kind of very Clive Barker, without perhaps the ironic moralizing or morality that is often part of a Barker story.
Fair.
Chanterelle's horror chooses a victim and has the ability to keep that victim alive. Even if that victim kills themselves, the horror can bring them back.
Literally recreating their body from just a single drop of blood.
Right. Bringing them back and them having the memories and everything of what they had done and sort of being like, no, I'm not done with you yet.
Yeah, I'm going to resurrect you.
I'm going to bring you back because I'm not done with you. There is more torment that I can derive from you.
Yeah.
The isolation ultimately that comes about as a result of Chanterelle's horror working on a victim.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about how some of the other horrors do isolate their victims in a way. Taint, for example. Yes. Taint manipulates and corrupts adept's powers to the point where they can't trust that they're going to work anymore. And so they need to isolate themselves in order to prevent harm from coming to others. That is a very similar sort of thing with Chanterelle's horror, but dialed up to 11 in a sense.
Well, to a different degree, yes.
Yeah. We've talked about the Despair Thought, for example, the iconic horror that tormented Jerol.
Yes.
Whose ultimate goal is for their victim to kill themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the depression and loneliness and isolation that they feel as a result of what is happening to them, for them to ultimately succumb to despair and end their own life. That's where the Despair Thought kind of gets its final tasty little meal before moving on to a new victim.
Yeah.
Chanterelle's horror does that, but then has the added twist of even that is not enough to free yourself, for lack of a better term, from the torment that is going on.
Yeah, it was.
You might think that you are freeing yourself or maybe sparing those near you by ending your life. Even that is denied you. And the even greater sense of despair and helplessness that would come about as a result of that. Ugh.
Agreed. Because in the essay, the person who had Chanterelle's horror, I mean, Chanterelle originally, thought that after a while, the horror had left it alone. Because it just went away. It wasn't in its thoughts. Wasn't in Chanterelle's thoughts or feelings or anything along those lines for decades. As Chanterelle lived in this place and made all kinds of friends and had some family. And then out of the blue, the horror showed up. And it was traumatic the way it showed up. Because what Chanterelle's horror does is it literally just eviscerates and vivisects those closest to you so that you can stumble upon their remains, and I'm using that term loosely, so that all of that immediate despair and immediate overwhelming sensation of fear and anguish just feeds the horror at this point, because...
Well, there's all that time where...
Yeah.
Maybe I'm free. Maybe yes. It's finally over. Maybe I can relax and be happy and form connections with people again.
Yep.
Nope. Sorry. We're going to take that all away from you again.
Yes. Again. And then it'll do like a despair thought. Well, it's like a despair thought. It never really leaves you until you kill it, and good luck killing it. But the special powers it has, and I'm going to usurp Josh this one real quick. I'll have you chime in a second or so, is the horror mark appears in the dreams of its victims. And then it can attack or mark those known to that victim. So it not only horror marks you, it horror marks people you're connected to. And they didn't have a say in this.
Right.
They had no idea. And distance does not matter. The example in the books is it can mark somebody in the Eris Sea and their relative is in Bartertown. Doesn't matter. So it'll mark everybody. And then it to Josh's point, draws sustenance from that loneliness and feeling of separation that you have, being separated from your loved ones or your friends. Then what it does is that the special power is this astral slice, where it literally can dissect you like boning a chicken. Well, not you, your loved ones, like boning a chicken. The examples in the book are absolutely Clive Barker, Stephen King, horror-ish, where the bones of one victim are over there in the pile, and the flesh is over there in another pile, and the skin is in a third pile. And you're like, oh, I didn't need to know that. So,
yeah, we have talked about the body horror and corruption and physical twisting and shaping that happens with constructs and things that horrors do.
Yeah.
Chantrell's horror, again, like turns that up to 11. Really, Clive Barker, thinking
yes.
Again, if you look at like the original Hellraiser movies, which are based on Clive Barker's Books of Blood.
Yes.
That is a very strong feeling that I get from Chantrell's horror. Is very Clive Barker in terms of the presentation.
I had the same thought, so I'm not going to dispute.
Yeah.
I disagree with that in any way, shape, or form.
Once it's marked its chosen victim, it can use that mark to mark others that are close to the victim. And the ease with which it can do that depends on how closely related they are. Blood relatives are super easy for it to mark.
Mm-hmm.
Romantic relationships, spouses, significant others, partners of whatever sort are a little bit more difficult. If you have a connection through a pattern item, say a group pattern or something like that, that is as easy as a blood relation, because that is a strong magical connection that can be very easily followed.
These are all part of the same pattern. Yeah.
Close friends are a little bit more, you know, again, kind of like going up that level. You've got blood relatives and thread connected people. Lovers, romantic relations, spouses, that sort of thing are kind of the next step. Then close friends, then acquaintances, people that you know are friendly with or whatever. And then beyond that point, you're getting to like, I had a trade deal with them once.
Yeah.
Obviously, the stronger the bond, the easier it is for the horror to then mark that associate and destroy them.
Yes.
And so allowing that time, that decade or two decades or whatever, where it completely retreats and allows those connections to be grown and reformed, only to then snatch them away.
It's like a spring-loaded trap.
Yeah. All of the horrors, to a certain extent, have had various capacity for evil.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about it, this is one of the ones that, on one level, I think is the most depraved.
Yeah.
Because in some regards, you've got the despair thought, you've got the bloat forms, you've got the worm skulls, you've got all of these horrors that ultimately are like tormenting and causing pain and suffering and hurt and all of this stuff. But ultimately, in the end, as tragic as it is, death is kind of a release. You don't get that with Chantrell's horror. If Chantrell's horror has decided that you are a particularly tasty morsel,
mm-hmm.
then it will bring you back to life. It will make you young again. Another aspect of its horror mark is that it can use its recovery tests on the marked victim, and when it has healed damage equivalent to the victim's death rating,
yeah.
the victim loses a year of life. And so the horror can effectively make them immortal and continue to
mm-hmm.
draw out that pain and suffering.
Yeah. I think that's its blood memory power, which is also...
The blood memory is what allows it to bring people back from the dead if, in fact, they are right. dead.
Yes.
The perpetual youth is just an aspect of its horror mark, because it does say that it allows the horror to use its recovery tests in order yes. to not only heal the victim, but to even potentially make them younger again. As it says, substituting its own immortal essence for that of the marked character.
Yep.
And on top of that, Chantrell's horror also has suppress mark. So it is even harder to detect the presence of the mark there in the first place, so that yes. a victim who would be aware of the mark, who would be aware of the presence of the mark based on what had happened to them before,
mm-hmm.
might go to folks who would be able to potentially search for the horror's mark in their pattern, but it can hide it away very deep and secretly yes. to maybe even have the victim think, oh, the mark isn't there anymore, and it hasn't been in my dreams for years. Maybe everything is okay now. Again, mm-hmm. setting up that cycle of hope and destruction and hope and destruction.
Yeah. Well, and for most of the horror's dealings, it's the main thing at stake is you. And maybe ancillary, the things at stake are maybe a loved one or a close friend or your partners in your gaming group. In your adventuring party, sorry, in character. For Chantrell's horror, the thing most at stake is everybody but you. And that's a different take on the horrors that we've come across so far.
Yeah, I mean, Chantrell's horror is not ultimately picky. The way that its power works, it can do this to anybody.
Yeah.
But I imagine that similar to how Ysirthgrath has this taste for long-lived beings.
Oh, yeah.
For elves and whatnot.
Obsidiman, yeah.
Elves and Obsidiman. It has this desire to really extend out the suffering. Ysirthgrath can't bring its victims back to life once they're dead.
No.
Chantrell's horror can, and so has an even broader buffet, potentially, to choose from to get this wonderful extended feast. And I suspect its desire of doing that for someone has to do with the personality and temperament of the victim. That there's almost kind of a relationship, you would think, between Chantrell's horror and Chantrell, as there is between, say, Ysirthgrath and Aena, in terms of that really strong desire. I just don't get, like, the toxic jealousy aspect of it from Chantrell's horror. In fact, it feels like there's almost an almost impersonally horrific.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like, there is no sense that I get from Chantrell's entry here, from mm-hmm. Chantrell's story. Obviously, it's kind of personal, right? The horror has marked her and mm-hmm. made her immortal and yeah. done this thing to her time and time again. But there's never any sense from the horror. The face smiled, and in a voice of whirring blades and metal scraping, it said, I missed you.
Yes.
That I missed you comes to me across like very Pinhead, very Cenobite, very
mm-hmm.
coldly alien in a sense.
Yeah.
Mentally, I don't get the sense of the raw emotion that you get from Ysirthgrath in terms of its relationship with its victims.
Agreed.
Again, there is a personal touch to Ysirthgrath that I don't necessarily get in the same way from Chantrell's horror.
I was beginning to look at it like a owner and a pet. Like I've been away on vacation. I came back to my pet at home. Oh, I missed you. To a certain degree, you can miss that thing there. Or the, I haven't had this fantastic meal in over a year and I've missed it. That's like that. You know, it's good to have every once in a while. I can't eat it every day. And that's kind of how I look at what Chantrell's horror was doing to Chantrell. Like, oh, I missed this. but I'll be back again. I'll come back to this restaurant and feast every once in a while.
So Chantrell's Horror, it is in some ways not difficult to bring Chantrell's Horror in to be something that player characters might have to deal with.
Yeah.
Because they don't need to necessarily have an encounter with it themselves in order to end up targeted by it. Any kind of close relationship that they have could be an avenue through which the horror could act.
Yeah.
You could end up with a 1 or 2 degrees of separation between them and what is going on, and they may realize that they are on the potential hit list for this entity. Because also, once it has them marked, then they could end up being the next victim that it is running its little spider web of deadly connections out of.
Yeah.
And it is a difficult horror to contend with because, by all accounts, appears to be an astral horror. It is not one that is ever seen in the physical plane. It invades dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And so tracking it down to defeat it,
it's really difficult.
Would be pretty difficult and require a significant amount of power. We've talked about some of its unique powers and abilities. On top of those, it has Cursed Luck. Always a fun horror power.
Oh, yeah.
It's got Karma Tap.
Oh.
Another amusing power. It's got Terror, because of course it does.
Of course. Why would it not?
And Circle 8 Elementalist equivalent.
Oh, man.
Along with, again, like attribute steps in the upper teens and low 20s.
Yep.
Multiple actions with high attack and damage steps, decent defense ratings,
massive death rating,
pretty significant death and unconsciousness rating.
Yeah.
You know, we keep coming back to it. This is the Clive Barker.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
This is not quite as blatant an homage as Giftbringer is, for example.
No, no. But this is a damn nice one.
Yeah. This is the Hellraiser homage.
Yeah.
In terms of just the visuals and the chains and blades and flayed skin.
Yeah, this is Saw and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Clive Barker all rolled into one plus.
Yeah.
You know, all your friends and family are, you know, going to be victims too, just because they know.
Right, right, right. So, yeah, it is.
Shiver down your spine, horror.
I really like that this is one of the horrors that carried forward for this book from the original rulebook.
Yes.
Verjigorm, we'll talk about Verjigorm in the future.
Yes.
Obviously also carries forward. Verjigorm is kind of this horror, you know, in terms of like lording over all the others. And we will talk about Verjigorm eventually.
Yeah.
I have mentioned in the past how Verjigorm, while in some respects the most powerful, the most formidable, the most frightening horror in that regard, is also a lot more of a cosmic force of nature than it is an entity like Chantrell's Horror or Ezerthgraf.
Yeah.
Verjigorm doesn't care about you. You are too small, really, to be noticed by it.
Yeah.
You are not too small to be noticed by some of the these other more sinister ones.
Yeah. Agreed.
Chilling.
Yeah. Chantrell's Horror is one of those. I'm like, I'm glad I read it now, because 20 years ago it would have absolutely given me nightmares, but that's just me. So folks, if you have any questions for us, or if you've used any of these horrors we've talked about, by all means, we'd like to know how those stories went. We had one last episode about Giftbringer. So please drop us a line at edsgpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. So until next time, go make Chantrell's Horror a nemesis for your legend.
Good night, everybody.